C+18. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. If a tree fell in the woods and no one was around to hear it, Dan McCarthy didn't know for sure whether it really would make a sound. But within minutes of President Slater's outright admission that a killer comet was hurtling towards Earth, he knew for sure that no one had listened to anything else she said. Dan was by now back in his own house following a phone call from Henry to check that everyone was safe and indoors. The exhausting stress of the last few weeks sometimes made Dan forget that Henry didn't know anything, nothing about the hoax, nothing about the plaque, and, until Cole's leak and Slater's public confirmation, nothing about the comet. It quickly became clear that Henry, along with Walter Byrd, who had crossed the street to join him as soon as the news broke, was more concerned with the short-term security of his family and their property than he was with the long-term security of their planet. The McCarthy's particularly quiet residential section of a generally quiet town was just about the last place in the world where disorder was likely to kick off. But the two salt-of-the-earth old-timers' fiercely self-sufficient natures ensured that they wanted to be ready to deal with anything that might come their way. They weren't nearly as attuned to the prospect of the shit hitting the fan as their good friend Phil Norris, the full-on prepper who owned New Care Grillin' and the rest of the drive-in lot, but some of Phil's philosophies had certainly rubbed off on them over the years. On the back of how much Henry's boys had done for Phil's business interests, Phil had more than once promised to let them share in his stash should the need ever arise. Henry knew that Phil was the kind of man who would sooner die than go back on his word, but he dearly hoped it would never be necessary for any of them to dip into the emergency supplies. As soon as Dan walked through the door, Henry suggested that everyone should stay together in one place. Everyone was there when he said this. Tara and Timo, as well as the old trio of Emma, Dan, and Clark, and they all agreed. Rooster, who had less say in the matter, looked more than happy with the temporary move as he explored every accessible corner of the house. Although Birchwood remained peaceful, no one was overly surprised by how quickly things went to hell elsewhere. The looting was immediate, and the rioting close behind. Both were widespread, and both overpowered law enforcement officers by virtue of the sheer scale of the disorder. Reporting on incoming footage from coast to coast, certain news anchors chose their words carefully when trying to make the point that many of those who had taken to the streets didn't look like so-called typical looters. And it was certainly true that gentrified and suburban areas, which were typically insulated from such disorder, had no such luck on this occasion. Some commentators on social media were quick to point out that this was because, for once, the issue behind the disorder affected everyone equally, rather than falling primarily on those in often stigmatized low-income neighborhoods. Social media itself became a news story as the night wore on, and several high-traffic sites buckled under a sudden surge of users, falling offline for longer than anyone could remember, and certainly for far longer than had been the case following the DS-1 launch disaster. This sparked conspiratorial thoughts in many people's minds that President Slater's government may have pulled the plug on them in an attempt to stop coordinated disorder, a well-used and conceptually proven tactic in less open democracies around the world. But these theories couldn't be broadly shared until the sites returned, by which point they were obviously moot, so the outages didn't cause any real problems beyond heightening the helplessness and fear felt by millions of Americans. Even when there was no one in the basement to see it, Dan's trend ticker scrolled through a variety of messages ranging in tone from despairing to conspiratorial. Some commentators, chiefly Joe Crabb, floated a conspiracy theory based on the point that a threat like Comet Conte Abate was just what the ill-defined powers that be had always wanted. A huge problem which demanded a huge solution, and one which would inevitably involve the consolidation of more and more wealth and power into fewer and fewer hands. Crabb's words were reported on several networks and appealed not only to citizens who distrusted their government, often for very valid reasons, but also to the broader mass of people who were desperate to grab hold of any coherent theory that justified some hope that a comet wasn't on its way to destroy their world. Dan knew that Crabb's ideas were ridiculous and quite possibly dangerous, but unlike some media commentators, he would forever argue that tolerating stupid and dangerous ideas was an important thing to do, Having been on the other side of this kind of thing when dismissed by almost everyone as an attention-seeking lunatic in the immediate aftermath of the IDA leak, Dan was only too aware of the dangers of letting some pedestaled authority subjectively decide which views merited discussion and which should be shut down as dangerous. As the night wore on, an unsettlingly nihilistic tone became an increasingly common element among the most shared social media posts. And rather than quickly die off, the looting got progressively worse as more and more people from all social strata began to realize that things were never going to be the same again, that tomorrow's deliveries probably weren't coming, and that the shelves quite possibly weren't going to be restocked. While a degree of looting had been seen in the hours after DS1's failed launch a year earlier, the scale was simply incomparable. Live footage from some inner-city areas showed instances of communities policing themselves to some extent, with a small number of individuals forcibly dissuaded from taking more from the ransacked stores than others saw as justifiable. To the disappointment of some reporters who had been instructed to get footage to fit certain narratives, no one was opportunistically grabbing luxury or electronic goods from their shelves. Instead, the core staples of food, bottled water, batteries, and hygiene products were the order of the day. News of the night's first confirmed looting-related fatality came from outside a high-end grocery store in Beverly Hills, but few doubted that others had come before and would soon come to light. "What we're seeing tonight is a far cry from the mass protests of recent weeks," an on-site Blitz News reporter incisively observed. "These scenes are more akin to an every-man-for-himself post-apocalyptic melee, or perhaps pre-apocalyptic is the more appropriate term."
"Seems like the time for puns,"
Walter Byrd sighed from the kitchen chair he had placed behind Dan's couch.
"These fuckers in the newsrooms want to make it worse,"
Henry grunted in reply.
"They don't care how bad this is going to get, as long as it brings in the ratings. And that goddamn John Cole," he said, turning specifically to Dan. "See, this kind of shit is exactly why I said I can see where Walker was coming from with his cover-up. I never said I agreed with him, but sometimes there's a reason why some things have to be kept under wraps. The world can't handle them."
Dan walked away, biting his tongue and trying not to shake his head too much. On more than a few occasions since picking up Walker's godforsaken folder on Winchester Street, he had experienced physically unsettling stress and anxiety of a kind he had never known before. It had often felt like his stomach was spinning, like something inside his head was physically swaying like a canoe in a rough tide, and like the ground under his feet was pulsing. But tonight it was different. Tonight it was stronger, more of an all-consuming, skin-crawling unease. He walked through the kitchen and out of the back door. He didn't look up at the stars, and he didn't look down at the ground. His eyes were open, but he wasn't really looking anywhere until he heard the door open again behind him and turned to see Emma, alone, walking out to join him.
"Do you know what I was just thinking?"
he said, his voice barely more than a whisper. Emma silently shook her head.
"If there was a button I could push to fast forward time and just end everything right now, I almost feel like I would push it."
"Dan, I never want to hear you say anything like that ever again."
"I did say almost."
Emma's expression was firm.
"And I said never."
She walked back inside without another word, leaving Dan alone again under the stars. Tonight he didn't feel like they were shining down on him. Tonight he felt like they were taunting him. His eyes were naturally drawn towards Il Diavolo's hiding place, from which it would all too quickly emerge. They then scanned the rest of the sky, as familiar as the back of his hand. He knew where the comet was, but that wasn't what was getting to him. Fear was gone. In its place, anger reigned supreme. Dan pinched the back of his neck, digging into the scar with his fingernails in the vain hope that it might work both ways and somehow facilitate contact with the indefensibly absent messengers. Nothing. It was difficult for Dan McCarthy to feel anything but abandoned, so he took a few more deep breaths of the fresh night air and walked back inside to be with the only people he could still count on. Clark was in the kitchen when Dan stepped inside, walking the other way to check on him.
"You okay, man? Is that blood on your hand?"
Dan looked down and wiped a small amount of blood from his fingertips and then from his neck. His t-shirt was black, at least, so he didn't think anyone else would notice.
"Did you feel something?"
Clark asked, his eyebrows and tone both rising in hopeful excitement. Dan shook his head and finally spoke the words he'd been trying to avoid accepting for so long.
"They're not coming back."